and online and across the globe on YouTube. And of course, each week we're joined by our planet experts, Dan the Man, Jackie Highway, and Steve Merritt from Phenomena Magazine. Welcome back in, guys.
Hello, everyone.
Good evening.
And it's been, well, we've got a busy packed show tonight, but it's been a busy packed day, hasn't it?
Oh, it's been chaos, hasn't
our
it?
Our first Planet X, organized chaos, our first Planet X live mini conference with, of course, Lloyd Pye. We've been down at the Novotel pretty much all day today. We arrived around about 8:30 this morning, so it's been a long old day, but a good one.
It's been a very good one, a very, very productive one.
Yeah, and we've met some lovely, lovely people, some people who do listen to the show, and some new people who don't listen to the show. So thank you to everybody who came down, and really nice to sort of get to
know the
people. Speak to people face-to-face.
It's fantastic, because they've all got stories to tell, and that's what really fascinates me. And you know what? You kind of go overload, because you're trying to take as much in as you possibly can, but there were some really interesting stories today.
Yeah.
From the locals. It was fantastic.
And of course, Lloyd was there doing his thing, a couple of hours of Lloyd, and we've got some interesting stuff. I mean, he's going to be on the show at 8:30 tonight, but interesting new information about the Star Child
story. Really interesting, because I've been following it for quite, well, I've known Lloyd for a long time, I've been following his work for a long, long time, even at the point where he did take 3 years out, and I thought, Lloyd's disappeared off the scene. And of course, there's a really good reason for that, and he may explain that a little bit later, but he's come back in regards that, you know, the information that was put out was incorrect, and it certainly took
people... You don't realise how long this man has been working away.
For years
13 years,
you know.
And spending his own money to try and
He just wants the conclusion. That's all he wants. And do you know what? He's getting stepping closer and closer and closer to it every year. And he's not far off, is he, Dan?
That was the gist of the talk, really, that, you know, he feels that he's on the brink of something very special in terms of the proof of actual extraterrestrial life on the planet. I mean, it's boggling, really, when you think about it. The actual to say for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
It's phenomenal.
And it's great the way that the technology, because when he first started, and again, we'll talk about this when Lloyd's here, but when he first started trying to get the skull DNA tested, the technology just wasn't there, was it?
It wasn't.
Now,
you have to wait for the technology. It's very expensive to have this stuff done, as you can well imagine. And there were only a number of facilities that could do that type of test, and not all of them will actually happily to go ahead and do that as well, taken into consideration. So it does limit you even further. As the time went on, as years passed, more people started doing that, and I think he had an option about a few in 2006 to 2007 that there were 24 options available. When he first started, I think there was something like 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. You know, so it is a growing thing, and more technology is coming forward. But the expense hasn't dropped much, unfortunately. But the type of testing on ancient DNA is ridiculous.
Well, even for he was saying, even if you're just trying to test a human for DNA,
it's about £10,000,
which made £15,000 for the whole human genome.
Do you know what I thought of straight away? Surely, what's his name? Jeremy Kyle can't be spending £10,000 on these DNA tests.
That's why Trisha went out of business.
Yeah, I think so. Is it really that expensive?
No, but also it's really good that when he comes over here, he's got the public behind him, because he was in Middleton when me and Steve went to see him a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. And this guy has approached him, he's offered him help in further research against it. And I think that's absolutely brilliant.
It is. More people are lending a hand to the cause now.
Yeah.
At first it was all very much standoff, because it was all a lot of question marks. But now we're starting to see evidence come forward, more and more people stepping forward to help with the cause, and that's just fantastic.
And Lloyd is going to be on the show in around about 25 minutes, half an hour or so, just after 8:30. We are going to talk about the Star Child skull, but I want to get into, I mean, this is the subject he loves, the hominoids.
Oh, well, that's obviously,
the Bigfoots and the Yetis.
I mean, I started listening to Lloyd because of that, because for me, he was the most significant researcher I know who's looked into the hominoids, the Bigfoots and all that sort of thing. You know, and that fringe of cryptozoology, he's the guy I'd obviously go to. And following his work for many years, but then of course he kind of stumbled across the skull and he ended up in a different direction slightly. And in his own admittance, he does actually miss researching, going back to the researching of the hominids and Bigfoot incidents and stuff. And it's absolutely fascinating what I've learned from him over the years regarding that matter. Getting into that subject, well, that's a whole new realm as well.
So if you want to get your questions into Lloyd, he's going to be on the show very, very soon. You can text, the text number, as always, is 61025. Start your text with the word talk. then your questions and your name as well. It'd be nice to give you a name check. So it's 61025. You can also get in touch via the Facebook or the forums.
That's right. You got the Planet X group on Facebook. It's Planet X City Talk 105.9. Of course, log on to www.planetxlive.co.uk and sign up to the forum. It's completely free, and you can win prizes if you sign up to the forum, as we'll find
absolutely
out in a bit.
Yeah, and if that was all too much information, if that was information overload, just go to the website planetxlive.co.uk, and all the links are there for the forum and Twitter and Facebook. Talking of which, nicely led in there, Dan, before the big competition, the weekend is next weekend. Mm. We're going to give that away in just a moment, but first, another competition. We've got the Psychic Roadshow, which is at the Hillcrest in Widnes. It's the Hillcrest Hotel in Cronton near Widnes. And the Psychic Roadshow featuring all of the City Talk psychics. They're going to be there this coming Thursday, the 20th of September. I think you guys are going to come down as well.
Yeah.
Mm. You can get one-to-one readings from 5 o'clock, and the live show is at 8 o'clock. If you'd like more information or maybe to get in touch to book a reading, then just go to the website citytalk.fm, click on surgery, and you'll get all the details there if you click on the psychic surgery. Now, we've got 2 tickets to give away, not just for the night, but also for a meal for 2 for the new restaurant. It's a very nice restaurant down at the Hillcrest. And are you ready for the question?
Yep.
This week's question, here we go.
Go for it.
Again, it's on the text. So if you think you know the answer to this, then stand by to text in. Talk. Jackie's getting her phone now. Text talk to 61025. Name the cards used more commonly used by psychics as a form of divination. Right?
Ooh.
Name a type of card used by psychics as a form of divination. If you think you know the answer, do you know the answer? Is that too hard for you?
No.
Do you want an A, B or C?
Yeah.
No, I'm not giving you one. So name the cards used by psychics as a form of divination. Text your answer along with your name to 61025. Start your text with talk, and you could win 2 tickets for the Psychic Roadshow at the Hillcrest Hotel this coming Thursday in Cronton near Widnes, and a meal for 2. Right, let's do Bufora. Mm. And again, all you had to do was post something on the forum, and Dave Stretch has emailed us the person, and I will give you his name. The username is Paros. Mm. Okay, so I don't know any more than that, but we've got the contact details. So it's Paros. Well done. A little ripple for Paros. Steve, tell us what he's won.
He's won a weekend trip to Bufora, the conference which has been held in London this year, which is Bufora's 50th anniversary conference, over the Saturday and the Sunday, and it's going to be a great weekend. We've got all the regular talkers there from Bufora. We've got Lionel Beer, who used to be the president. He's going to be talking about, of course, all ufological matters. Gloria Dixon, who's one of my mentors, a lovely woman. She's going to be talking, of course, about probably, if I know Gloria, the fringe elements of ufology, some of the strange and profound experiences of them. Of course, we've got John Spencer, who's a fantastic lecturer, talking about strange things in aerial sightings and so on. Even Lionel Fanthorpe is visiting. He may even knock us a tune out on his guitar at the same time. Fantastic. And going on to, of course, we've got Jenny Vandals as well. Prolific author of UFO books in the country. Going into Sunday, we've got Tony Eccles, a good friend of mine. He's been in the subject for a very long time, actually. And he'll probably be talking about something. He used to be one of the principal investigators in Merseyside. He actually did a book, which is also available. I think it's still available over the internet, which was a very good book. And of course, John Hanson, who's releasing a set of encyclopedia books and UFOs, he's going to be talking about some of his work.
So some great talkers there.
We've got some fantastic
speakers. It's their 50th anniversary, isn't it?
Yeah, 50th anniversary. It's a full event for over the 2-day period. It's the biggest conference that's been held in London this year regarding UFO, so fantastic.
Brilliant. So well done to Paros. Just for posting something on the forum, you've got yourself tickets for that weekend. And we've, of course, got a big David Icke competition, which we will probably do a little bit closer to the time when he's on. In fact, we might even get David to set the question when he's on at the end of the month, the 30th of September. Now, before we go anywhere else, we've got to mention it was, of course, the 11th anniversary of 9/11. We couldn't let that go without talking about it, albeit briefly. Mm-hmm. We're not really going to do it justice in the time that we've got, but we've got to mention it. Was it on Tuesday or Wednesday?
Yeah, it was a back-to-back programmes, weren't they, all over the television?
Yeah.
Some of them were really interesting. Some of them I hadn't seen, and of course, there's always new information you come across. Another stone to the mountain of evidence we've got to make, to suggest that something unusual actually certainly happened.
11 years ago it happened, and it's one of those moments in history. I think everybody knows what they were doing and where they were. I remember I was just, I think I had the television on, and then all of a sudden these images started coming through.
Did you actually watch it happen?
Well, I thought it was a film.
I did myself, actually, at first, and I thought it was just one of those kind of funny documentary things. What were you doing, Jackie?
Well, I was in work, and one of our head offices was over in Philadelphia, and we got the phone call, and we saw the directors run straight into the conference room. Tellies went on, the directors came out and said, does everybody want to just go and have a look at the television screens in the conference room? And we all went in, and we couldn't believe what we were seeing, and it was unreal.
Quite shocking.
It was.
Dan, what were you doing?
I was here in the Liverpool City Centre doing a bit of shopping. Nipped in for a quick pint, and there it was
again
on the news screen.
Oh,
dear.
And there it was. All the punters were watching on TV.
Yeah, everyone was watching on TV screen, and again, similar sorts of reactions. What's this? It can't be real. It was that type of thing.
A lot of people sort of thought the same thing. It's just you couldn't accept what was actually happening. It was only about 10 or 15 minutes later when I actually saw the second plane hit the second tower. That was when the realism sort of came in and said, well, this isn't a staged event. This isn't a documentary, it's not a film, it's actually happening before my very eyes. And that is when I decided to ring around everybody, and of course all the networks, there was a thing in the paper the following day about all the networks, and some of them actually went down, didn't they, because the amount of phone calls that people were making just to let other people know to watch television.
Well, it was 11 years ago this week, and we've got one of the leading researchers on the line, friend of the show, Andrew Johnson. Welcome back to Planet X.
Hi there, Neil. Thanks for asking me to come on.
It's great to have you on. Now, when I first met you, you gave me this fascinating book, which is the book Where Did the Towers Go? By Dr. Judy Woods. And it really is that the book contains physical evidence, not really your theories or your speculation. And this is a book that you talk and do lectures on as well, isn't it?
Well, to some extent. I mean, obviously Dr. Judy Woods written the book, and I've been associated with her since, we came into contact through this scholars group that I joined called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. So I kind of first got in touch with her in early 2007, late 2006, that sort of time. So I realised that this story that was being circulated within the so-called truth movement was there were some problems with it, which is it's also quite difficult for people to sort of take in. And I've ended up writing a whole book about that, as well, because of all the things that were going on not really behind the scenes as such, but, you wouldn't necessarily know these things were going on if somebody hadn't written them all down and put them on the website, so to speak. As you said there in the introduction, the book isn't, there's no speculation in the book at all. It's all about physical evidence. You've got 500 full-colour pages. You've got 800 pictures and diagrams from seismic data. You've got also sets of photographs about the World Trade Center, how that was, how it was destroyed. And you can see that actually one of the big things which you have to take into account when you're looking at 9/11 is that the towers actually turned to dust. And Dr. Wood shows this in the book, that they did indeed turn to dust. Approximately 85 to 90% of the whole buildings turned to dust just in that period of time. Well, it probably took about an hour for them to turn to dust, but we saw as it came down, what actually hit the ground was dust. There was almost no solid material there. In fact, I think about the lower 20 stories were mainly there still. But above that, about 90 stories were turned to dust, and that included, toilets, filing cabinets, computers, desks, chairs. Everything was gone. And one of the key things that you can see, and I showed this at the conference in Liverpool in August, is this clip, which is about 6 or 7 seconds long, where you can see 70 stories of unsupported steel turning to dust before your very eyes. And this is the story that no one wants to address, apart from a few people that have looked at the book and looked at some of the videos which we've sort of put together over the years, and a few other people have put together in support of what we're trying to show people. And
Andrew, I've got to say, isn't it true that never in history has a steel building collapsed through, is it fire, or well, that, my facts
that,
right?
That is true, but the point is that the buildings didn't collapse either. They turned to dust. You know, the sort of statement really is, never before have two, or indeed three, buildings turned to dust in history before your very eyes. So yes, that's correct. You know, I mean, other people make the analogy with the fire, you know, the fires at the Madrid Tower, you know, I think that was in 2005. They had a huge fire in a hotel in Madrid, which the building didn't sort of turn to dust, and it didn't come down either. It just stayed there. One of the other key factors is that comes out is all the strange phenomena which you can find in the evidence if you actually go that far in looking at the photographs. For example, cars which were mysteriously affected about a quarter to half a mile away from the World Trade Center. We have this parking lot of cars where, for example, all the cars are parked in the parking lot about a quarter of a mile from the World Trade Center, and we have pictures of before the towers came down, and then just after the towers came down, all these cars were suddenly burned. They had this burned appearance, but they didn't. A few of them actually burst into flames, and some of them just had various weird melting. The outside of the car was damaged, whereas in some cases, the upholstery inside the car was not as badly damaged. So it seemed there were characteristics of heat, but then next to that you could see there can't have been any heat because, you know, things like plastic and rubber were either not melted at all or only partly melted. So, and you also had, for example, people were being levitated. We had David Hanscher, the photographer for the New York Daily News. He reports that as one of the towers is coming down, he's levitated and carried a block. And we had cars turned upside down, a number of those turned upside down. We had Patricia Ondrovich running down the street, and the cars were sort of bursting into flames as she's walking down the street, and her coat seemed to catch on fire.
Is this part of the... In Judy's book, she talks about the evidence for directed free energy technology. Is this all down to this?
Essentially, that's what it looks like. When you look at all this evidence, what you're basically looking at is energy phenomena. That's the initial conclusion which she came to, or the initial discovery which she came to. Around about the end of 2006, she kind of sort of went, it became more public then. She had stuff posted before then, but it was more or less towards the end of 2006 when she'd begun to sort of say, you know, these are energy effects that we're seeing in this evidence. And then she went forward from there, and eventually finding these other strange effects with, for example, the levitation and, effects on the materials. For example, we had some of these beams that were remaining, the few that were left, two or three of them were actually bent into like a horseshoe shape. And if you imagine a building collapsing, there is no possible way, if you look at the stress, I mean, this is Dr. Wood's area of specialty. She's a specialist in materials engineering science, so she knows about, you know, stresses on material, free body diagrams, and how materials behave when they're put under stress, because that's what her PhD was in. And what was seen is, with some of these beams, they, for example, showed very similar effects to that seen in experiments done by a chap called John Hutchison, who's a Canadian independent experiment researcher, and he'd been researching into Nikola Tesla's work in the 70s and 80s, and his experiments attracted the attention of Los Alamos National Laboratories in 1983, when Colonel John Alexander, who is one of these UFO debunkers, funnily enough, if you go and check him out, he went to visit John Hutchison in 1983 for 4 months and watched him do these experiments by bending metal and imitating things and creating some weird fire effects, which were also seen at the World Trade Center. So eventually in 2007, Dr. Wood had sort of posted that there was some connections. You know, she didn't say it was the exact same thing, but there seemed to be a connection between what was seen in John Hutchison's experiments and the effects that's seen in the evidence at the World Trade Center. And, you know, since then, really, we've just been gathering more evidence that that's the case. And, of course, one of the other things that people come across when they go onto the internet and, you know, become quite skeptical of 9/11 as the official story is that they find out about this statement that thermite was used. And this thermite story, which I've written quite a lot about, I've got a whole blog about this thermite story and why it's untrue, is that this was started by a chap called Stephen E. Jones, Professor Stephen E. Jones. And he was formerly of Brigham Young University, as an emeritus professor there now, I believe, when he's retired. And he started this story in 2005, but funnily enough, I discovered in 2006 or 2007, when somebody sent me a video clip, that this same Stephen E. Jones was involved in research into a phenomenon which became known as cold fusion, which is more correctly termed low-energy nuclear reactions or chemically assisted nuclear reactions. And he was involved in that field for 2 years, more or less, until they shut it down, because what we heard is that there are appears to be a relationship between some of the effects seen in John Hutchison's experiments and this cold fusion, this low-energy nuclear reactions. So it was peculiar that this guy who started the thermite story had some research experience in that very field of energy phenomena, and I would contend from the evidence that we've collected about this chap, mm-hmm. that he was actually put there deliberately by, you know, some group or other to make people think that it was thermite that did it. And then this theory was then taken forward by the Architects and Engineers group, who again I've written quite a lot about, and that group has essentially received quite a high profile. They posted a new documentary in the last couple of weeks, which features members of that group talking about thermite and bombs in the building and so on. And, you know, I've written a whole book about this, and if people want to go to my website, checktheevidence.com, they can download that in iPad, Kindle, audiobook formats and PDF formats. So you've got free access to all that information, you know, to find out exactly what these folks have said. You can listen to audio clips, you know, of them actually saying these things, so, you know, you can prove that it's not just me saying it, so, or anything like that. So essentially what we've got, I know we've covered an awful lot in a short time, but we've got a cover-up within a cover-up. We've got the official story, which is, you know, just a cover story. Then we've got various other 9/11 truth movement stories, such as micro-nuclear devices, thermite, mini nukes, underground nukes, which was pushed by a chap called Dmitry Karlazov. And I've gone through all these, and I've looked into them, and I've written about them, and I've actually, in many cases, corresponded with the people who've come onto the scene and proposed these theories. And in just about every case, they've either ignored very substantial evidence, such as, for example, one thing we haven't mentioned, which is the presence of Hurricane Erin, which...
This was totally not mentioned at all on any of the weather channels in America.
Well, it was mentioned. I mean, we have to get this right, because I collected four news bulletins from about 8:40 in the morning on 9/11, and two of them mentioned the hurricane, and two of them didn't, and only one of them mentioned it by name, and they claimed it wasn't going to be a problem. I think it was the Fox News broadcast said it wasn't going to be a problem. But again, the thing is that this hurricane had been going in a straight line for 4 days from Bermuda towards New York City, and it ended up closest to New York City at 8 o'clock in the morning, just before the events unfolded, and then on September the 12th made a right-hand turn, and it moved off out towards Newfoundland, which of course is very peculiar. But let's just say, you know, the hurricane wasn't suspicious, there's nothing wrong with it. Obviously it was hurricane season, everyone knows that, or just about everyone. You know, so the fact that there was a hurricane, you know, off the coast of America for that time of year, not unusual. The path is extremely unusual, and the reporting was unusual unusual because if the hurricane had stayed where it was, you would have had storm swells, you know, so the sea would have washed up and it would have got quite strong waves. And if these waves had washed in towards Manhattan, you know, after 12, 13 hours or something, they would have could have flooded the subway system and things like that. So there would have had to be an evacuation.
So what do you say? Are you saying that there was a naturally forming hurricane that was diverted in some sort of way?
Well, we don't really have enough information to say whether the hurricane was created, you know, and then moved, or. But it does very much seem, if you look at the evidence, that it was steered and it was arranged to go up to essentially up to a chalk line, because if you look at the plot and you look at the path, you know, and this is at the, I checked this in three different places. I checked it at the UK Met Office, I checked it on the NOAA site, which is the American Weather Service, and the Canadian Hurricane Data Centre. They'll all show you the same data, this peculiar path, and there's no hurricane has had a path quite like that at that time of year. We had, I think, Hurricane, there was one a couple of years ago, Hurricane Bill had a vaguely similar path, but obviously there were no events associated with that.
Andrew, we're running out of time. You've covered a lot of ground already, and as you've just mentioned, whole load of strange anomalies connected with 9/11. Stay right there for a second, though, because I want to play this. And this is what a lot of the experts are up against still in America when you go on the mainstream. You've got the likes of CNN, you've got ABC, and I've got this great clip from the O'Reilly show on Fox News. He's speaking to a professor, I think it's Fetzer, and he doesn't even let him get a word in edgeways. But this is what you're up against if you go on the American mainstream media with maybe an alternative theory about 9/11. Take a listen to this.
In the next segment tonight, as we told you last night, University of Wisconsin instructor Kevin Barrett has called President Bush a murderer, saying he orchestrated 9/11 without providing a shred of evidence of that charge. Despite that defamation, Barrett, teaching a course on Islam this semester at the University of Wisconsin, the only sanction against him is an order to stop making public statements. Joining us now from Madison is James Fetzer, a recent retired professor from the University of Minnesota Duluth who supports Barrett. You know, I'm getting a little tired of Barrett and Ward Churchill and other college professors who hate their country and who bring this hatred onto a campus full of impressionable students. Am I wrong to be offended and angry about that, sir?
Well, you are wrong, Bill, because you haven't studied the case. We've created an organization consisting of experts and scholars, pilots, aeronautical engineers, mechanical engineers, structural engineers, civil engineers, physicists. We've been examining what the government's been telling us, and frankly, Bill, it's a fantasy. None of the major claims made by the government can be sustained. We've been looking at this from every point of view. The government has a story it wants to sell us. We're not buying it.
Okay, you don't have to buy anything. You're American. You want to be a nut, you can be a nut. And you are a nut. Because in order for any conspiracy of this magnitude to take place, thousands of Americans would have to buy into it, would have to know about it, and would have to keep their mouth shut about it. That's never going to happen. You're like the guys who think that the space aliens kidnapped Elvis or something like that. That's where you are, in my opinion. So your opinion is that Bush murdered everybody on 9/11 to seize control and make him the dictator of America, whatever the crazy thing it is. And my opinion is you are nuts. We're both entitled to our opinion, okay? So you're entitled and I'm entitled. And we'll let the folks decide. Well, hold it. But now you have a guy, Barrett, who's in a classroom, and we had the students on last night, and believe me, the students don't know very much, and here's Barrett, and here's Ward Churchill, and they're bringing their crazy theories in, explaining this, that, and the other thing, and whatever conclusions you guys have reached. And the students are there absorbing this. And I'm saying this is grossly irresponsible because it's based on nothing. If you had any evidence, sir, you would be on the front page of the New York Times in a heartbeat.
There you go. Totally non-biased journalism at its very best. What do you think of that, Andrew?
Well, it's very interesting to hear that. I've not actually heard that clip. But unfortunately, both those guys, both Jim Fetzer and O'Reilly, do not want to know people to know the truth about 9/11. Now, I've written a lot about Jim Fetzer because I interacted with him, and he started to attack me when I started to say that the Hutchison effect was very relevant to what happened on 9/11. So although on the face of it from that broadcast, Fetzer appears to be somebody who's speaking out and sticking his neck out, what you actually find, and it took me probably 2 years to find this out, that he is also part of the cover-up. And that's what's very, very difficult for people to comprehend, because, you know, when you get a broadcast like that, they wouldn't even suspect that that in of itself is just another circus for people in the truth movement to sort of get them fired up against, you know, O'Reilly. And Barrett is also part of that, the other guy that was mentioned, Kevin Barrett. And I've met both these two guys as well, so I know, but I've interacted a lot. I've been on Fetzer's radio show possibly two or three times, and I've got recordings of all that on my website, so you can find out. And you would never believe, for example, that Jim Fetzer actually threatened Dr. Judy Wood, but I've got the email evidence which shows that that's what he did.
Any chance of getting you on the O'Reilly show?
I would doubt it. You see, I'm not that I would go on, because, you see, that when you go into that environment, they might give you 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And they can just, you know, they can just steamroller over you. Whatever you show them, whatever evidence you give them, they can just steamroller over it. So I would probably not go on a show like that, because you're just not
You've
given
got no
the
chance.
Time.
No chance. No. And they're all at it over there, the CNN and ABC doing the same thing. Listen, we're going to have to wrap it up there. I was going to just finish by saying it's been a monumentous week in Liverpool after 23 years, a lot of hard work, sweat and tears for all the families involved with Hillsborough. The truth finally came out there, and I don't think anyone was actually prepared for how much would come out. And with 9/11 and 7/7, there's still, you know, there's still the conspiracy theories connected with that. But with Hillsborough, I think it's proved to a lot of people, to the average person in the street, that people in authority, your governments, people who are supposed to uphold the law, can lie, can cover up, and can break the law. And I don't want to try and to make too many similarities, although 3,000 people lost their lives 11 years ago in connection with 9/11. Do you think, you know, is it going to take 20-odd years? Will we see more truth coming out in our lifetime?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I've come to the conclusion from my own sort of what I've discovered and what I can show to people that it's very difficult to take it all in, and I don't think any group, and I've said this several times, that any large group, whether it's a church group, a government group, you know, a government body, they can't handle this truth. They can't handle, you know, they can't handle the idea that you've got this completely separate group, you know, which is strong ties with the military-industrial complex, and that comes out from what Dr. Judy Wood discovered and what she put into her court case in 2007. You know, you can read about all those ties. So it's very, very insidious, and it becomes very, very complicated. And I don't know that many people who've got the time and the, you know, the sort of effort to really get to the core of it. Beyond that, I think people are becoming more suspicious of, you know, what government inquiries do and what they say. I think there is a greater level of suspicion, and now we can do our own investigations using the internet if we take the time to do so. I think, you know, government inquiries are going to get a harder and harder time, hopefully, and hopefully more people in authority are going to see that they themselves are being manipulated by, you know, the higher-ups, and being forced to tell lies when they don't really want to. So hopefully we're going to see a trend to more people saying, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm going to tell the truth. You know, a bit like Tony Farrell. I don't know if you had Tony Farrell on, but a bit like what he's done.
Yeah, and he was going through, you know, a bad time with South Yorkshire Police, ironically. Andrew, we've got to leave it there because we're totally out of time, but thank you for coming on and doing your best with 9/11 in just such a short space of time. Where Did the Towers Go? It's a great book, and I think there's links there on your website, but just give us your website again if people want to get in touch.
It's checktheevidence.com, and we've got this event at Derby at the end of the month, so if people want to come to that, and details are on the website as well.
Brilliant. And I think we're going to get you back on very soon for a chemtrail special. But in the meantime, thank you, Andrew Johnson.
Thanks very much, Neil.
Planet X. The truth is on air. City Talk 105.9.
Okay, we are well over time, but before we go to our first break, there's a great story that Dan has picked out this week. It's all about Kapow! Runcorn.
That That's right. Runcorn's red-eyed vigilante superhero strikes again. For those of you who don't know, Runcorn's a small town on the Mersey, not far from where we are in Liverpool. And I picked this report up in the week from Daniel McKenzie of the Runcorn Weekly, Witness Weekly World News. And it reads, a second alleged sighting of a red-eyed vigilante has sparked rumours that a superhero is fighting crime in Runcorn.
Ooh.
The Weekly News has now received two reports of a masked man dressed all in black with glowing red eyes coming to the rescue of victims of crime. The latest report claims the mystery man stopped a gang of hooded youths from stealing a motorbike near Town Park on Friday night. It follows a letter which alleged that a similar looking figure fought off two men who were hassling a woman near the Royal British Legion. The latest anonymous letter said, upon my best crime watch voice here, I was walking my dogs in the Town Park this Friday when I saw a group of about six lads coming out of the trees. They were clearly intoxicated and looking for somebody that had at least three had weapons.
Mm.
One had got a large stick and the other two had got golf clubs. It was pitch black and I feared for my safety. Then what happened was the weirdest thing I have seen in 52 years of living in Runcorn. A man with glowing red eyes dressed all in black and with a black SAS style mask dropped down from a tree about 50 foot ahead of me. Half of the group started running away, but the three with weapons charged towards him and started swinging the golf clubs. Whoever he was, he obviously had some kind of combat training because he moved so fast and disarmed all of the three men in just a few seconds. No sooner had it happened, the man just disappeared out of sight. It was exactly how the other woman described it. He was just like a superhero.
Wow. Now, if Steve, this is right up your street, you've got to do an investigation
into
this.
I'm going to get my teeth into it, hopefully. I just hope that I do.
Glowing red eyes as well.
Yeah, yeah. And what's interesting when you say about glowing red eyes, because we've heard about the glowing red eyes in the Mothman prophecies.
That's right, yeah.
Of a flying sort of, you know, person, half flying beast with red eyes. But then, you know, we've also got sort of the little tales of this, of Spring-Heeled Jack.
Spring-Heeled Jack, yeah.
So it's absolutely fascinating, isn't it, straight away, Alice? So, yeah, I'm certainly going to hopefully get my teeth into it,
Dig away. And if anybody from the area, from Runcorn, is listening, if you've seen this...
we've got to keep tabs on the red-eyed
vigilante. The red-eyed vigilante.
Maybe we can get him on the show.
Yeah, that'd be great.
He has got a Facebook page.
Has he?
Yeah.
No.
Really?
It's just come up here.
Yeah.
Someone's posted it.
Well,
no, it's a YouTube clip. Oh, my Lord.
Oh, yeah.
This is brilliant.
We'll update this next week. Okay.
We'll get this updated next week.
I guess there's only one thing we can say to all that.
Holy interplanetary yardstick. Holy known unknown flying objects. Holy disappearing act.
Exactly, Robin.
And Lloyd Pye is on the way next.
The radio show that officially does not exist. This is Planet X. Planet X on City Talk 105.9.
Auto Glass Repair. Auto Glass Replace.
John, 31, technician for Auto Glass.
My last customer at Autoglass had been driving along when a little chip he'd ignored in the corner of his windscreen cracked. You see, every chip will eventually crack. There are loads of ways it can happen. Going over a pothole or a speed bump, turning your aircon up in hot weather, or simply the vibrations of the road. He called our UK-based call centre directly, and I was soon out replacing the screen, but I couldn't save him his pricey insurance excess for the new one. If he'd just called Autoglass when he first saw the chip, I could have repaired it instead. With more technicians than anyone else, we cover the entire UK, so we'll come to wherever is best for you to do the work, meaning your day isn't disrupted, especially as our repairs only take about 30 minutes. And if you fully comp, it's usually free for you and won't affect your no-claims bonus.
Call Autoglass directly on 0800 234 234 or visit autoglass.co.uk.
Autoglass Repair.
One more thing. Most insurers recommend us, so no need to call them first.
Autoglass Repair. Autoglass Replace.
Enterprise South Liverpool Academy, today's choice for a brighter future. This year, our outstanding results saw 91% of students gain 5 or more GCSE grades A star to C, exceeding all government targets. Come along to our Year 6 Open Evening on Thursday the 20th of September from 4 p.m. and discover why Enterprise South Liverpool Academy is the right choice for your child. For more information, call Enterprise South Liverpool Academy on 294 3150.
Actually, there is one more thing, Doctor.
It's probably nothing, but it might not be worth troubling you. It's just a bit of blood.
It doesn't matter how you tell your doctor, just tell them. Blood in your poo, looser poo, and going more often than usual are all possible signs of bowel cancer. Chances are it's nothing serious, but if you've had any of these symptoms for 3 weeks or more, tell your doctor. Finding it early makes it more treatable and could save your life. Be clear on cancer.
Hi, can I help you at all?
Yes, do you have these in a four?
Sure, let me take a look for you.
Thanks.
Here we go, size four.
Oh, they're perfect. I bet they cost loads.
Let's see. The price label says one blender you bought 4 years ago but never used. The steam iron your auntie Jill bought you when you moved in with Tony but you just keep under the stairs. And the exercise bike you hang your clothes on.
Oh.
Buy the things you want with the stuff you don't. Visit ebay.co.uk. You'll be surprised by what you can sell.
Don't get left out in the cold. Make sure you take advantage of the free home insulation offer from British Gas, worth up to £1,000 including installation. You don't need to be a British Gas customer and you could save hundreds of pounds every year on your energy bill. This free offer ends 30th of November, so give us a call on 0800 148 8888 or search British Gas Insulation. Subject to eligibility and limited availability, conditions apply. Look after your world with British Gas.
You're listening to Planet X. Planet X, the biggest paranormal show on radio. City Talk 105.9.
Oh, the Illuminati have got us again. My music's not working. Can you try and find the music again?
Why not? Give it another whirl.
Let's see if I can find the music. Just talk amongst yourselves,
everybody. Put
number
50p in the meter there.
Here we go. We're going to have the music.
There's a star.
Yeah. And we've got the star man here. A nice round of applause for Lloyd Pye live in Liverpool. We've got to get that on, haven't we?
What a good choice.
We were Googling star type things, and that's the one that came up. Listen, Lloyd, it's been great having you here in Liverpool. You've done a fabulous talk today. We're going to get on to the Star Child
right,
in the next hour. If you want to get in touch with Lloyd, by the way, keep the text coming in, 61025, and on Facebook and the forums as well.
That's right. And the group on the Facebook group is Planet X City Talk 105.9 and www.planetxlive.co.uk for the forum.
Okay, so we'll get into the Star Child. And as you were talking about in the talk today, some great new evidence after 13 years. We're kind of getting there.
Right, almost there. Last hurdle.
Yeah, so looking forward to that in the next hour. But for now, let's talk one of my favorite subjects, hominoids.
Hominoids, indeed.
Bring it on.
Well, I mean, you know, hominoids are, for those who don't know that term, we've sort of usurped it in the field because it's not in use anymore by zoology. But it means upright walking human primate bipeds, not hairless bipeds like we are, but hair-covered primates, basically upright walking chimps and gorillas. Those are hominoids. And the Russians actually started using that word first. They do a lot of research there, and it's a good term. It fits what they are. They are human-like, where they're just covered with hair, and they are primates, like upright walking chimps or upright walking gorillas.
Now, everybody's heard about the Bigfoots,
right,
the Yetis.
Right.
Sasquatch,
Bonobos, Nomad, Alma,
all
the names all over the world, haven't we? Yeah.
But are these all different? Are they the same species?
Well,
has it all breakdown?
As Steve said, there are a couple of hundred names for them around the world because every region where they live has its own specific name. For example, in Florida, where I live, they're called skunk apes. Because they have, you know,
a very
strong body odor. Exactly. People distinctively say, God, that stink smells like a garbage dump. Mm. But anyway, and primates do that. Primates have that feature. Go to any monkey house or
no
house
doubt.
And you'll smell it.
but the primates actually come in four basic size categories. There's the giant size, which is indeed Bigfoot and Sasquatch, and they're about 8 to 10 feet tall.
Is that roughly the same size as the Gigantopithecus, or would they be?
They would have been, right. The descendants of Gigantopithecus would indeed be the largest kind of hominoid. Mm. But they're also the Yeti, abominable snowman, as you said, which is considered man-sized relative to the giant, but we're talking 5 to 7 feet tall, 300 to 500 pounds. And then there's another man size, which is much more sophisticated. The Yeti, abominable snowman, type live only in the Himalayan ranges. They're not known outside the Himalayan ranges, and they have specific adaptations to their feet for dealing with, you know, mountains and steep terrain. Yep. But the ones that live in the lower lands, in the forests of the lower lands, are called Almas Almas and Captors. And Almas is just the word. I mean, everybody uses that one for that particular type, like Bigfoot. Or Bigfoot is in America, Sasquatch is in Canada.
Mm. Is the wild man of Borneo one of those?
They are. Actually, that's are the
they're kind. Supposed to be red like orangutan.
They're the fourth kind, yeah. So you got the Almas, which are also man size, 5 to 7 feet tall. And then you have the ones that are pygmy-sized, and they are around 4 feet tall, and they live in the jungles that circle the equator. You know, the band of jungle that circles the equator where there is land, there you will find the pygmy kind of hominoid, and they have the dominant name of them are Agagwes or Sadapas or like that. And then the hobbit, the recently discovered hobbit, was the skeleton of one of them. And the natives all there on the island of Flores, so I was just one of them.
I suppose it's feasible because we do have pygmy humans, don't we? You know,
absolutely.
So,
yeah,
it's the Halawi tribe, I believe. You're always saying we're the Halawi, aren't we?
Indeed. But those four kinds, based on size and weight, and then all of the names come from those four types, depending on where they live. And each lives in a different kind of terrain. People always ask, well, if they're, you know, how could they be there if we live everywhere, if we live all over the planet? We have a gross, like body dysmorphia. We have planet dysmorphia. We believe that we live everywhere, when in fact, if you take away all of the deserts, the ice caps, the tundra, and just go with the arable land where things kind of like us can live, we dominantly control half of that. The other half is just, for us, terra incognita, pretty much. It is deep, deep forests and deep, deep swamps, jungles, things like that, where when we do live near there, it's right around the edge of the perimeter. We don't go way deep into it where there's no Walmart or there's no, you know, drugstore or anything like that.
And some of these areas, they are huge expanses, aren't they?
All you have to do is fly around the world and just look out of your plane and you'll see just endless stretches of forest. And that is where they live. It really is. I mean, absolutely, you can look it up. It is half and half. We own about half of the arable land of this planet. They own the other half. So they've got as much room as we do. And look, there's literally 7 billion of us. Mm. Now, we live, you know, packed on top of each other, so I'm not saying there's 7 billion in them, but there are hundreds of thousands of them.
Yeah, because the research that I was reading recently was that the lowland gorilla is now down to 90,000 in the wild, but you're saying that these hominoids are a lot more of those.
In order to maintain breeding populations over vast, vast chunks of terrain, you have to have quite a number just so they can meet up and reproduce, which they do. You know, there's a lot of evidence that they've been seen in groups and in families with, you know, adults with children with them. I mean, the amount of testimony that comes in from people, you can't say it's evidence, but it's testimony. And that's staggering how much there is. I mean, we get in the world, there are about 150 good sighting reports per year. Around the world, about 150. And I mean, those are quality. That's not just, you know, there are a lot of them that come in that can't be considered, you know, good quality. Mm. So there's plenty of ongoing evidence, and there's very good historical evidence for them.
Native Americans, but a lot of indigenous tribes around the world over thousands of years have all got stories about these creatures, haven't they?
Absolutely. They really do. And going back to the best piece of evidence that we have, I mean, the best piece, is the Patterson-Gimlin film of 1967, but also in the same year, 1967, something occurred that most people don't know about, which is the killing of the Minnesota Iceman by a guy named Frank Hansen. And Frank Hansen, rather than turn it over to science, I mean, this would all be over. This whole hominoid thing would be over in 1967 if Frank Hansen had been a different man. But he had worked in carnivals and sideshows when he retired from the military. So he was just, he was ingrained as a hustler. He was ingrained to hustle people. So when he killed this thing, he froze it into a freezer, put plate glass over it, and put it in the back of a tractor trailer, and he took it around to county fairs and shopping malls that were opening.
Did you get a chance to see this yourself?
I did. I saw it with my own eyes.
And what did you make of it? Well, actually seeing it yourself.
Well, Frank Hansen was afraid of being arrested for having killed a human or a human-like thing.
Of course, yeah.
So he put out a lot of smoke and mirrors about, well, it's not really that, and he had a model made, and he froze the model and all that. So whenever the FBI or anybody came sniffing around, he would just show them the model, and then he would take the real one out, and whoever saw it would report back, oh, it's clearly a model. It's clearly. But if you saw the real one like I did, you could see the bullet holes. You can see the shreds of flesh coming out of the bullet holes.
See those details.
You could see.
What about the face? Is it human-like?
No. It's very primate-like. Not human-like at all.
More like an ape.
Had a big, big wide pug nose pulled up like that. Big, thick, fat, wide nose. It had, its eyes were blown out because he shot it. He first shot it in the back, apparently between its shoulder blades, because it had a nice big bloody hole in the middle of its chest.
Right.
But that didn't kill it. And he walked up to it to finish it off, and apparently was up on its right elbow, and it lifted its left arm. As he raised the gun to point it to its face, it lifted its hand up, and he shot it through the wrist, and the bullet went through the wrist and shattered it and blew that eye out in the back of the head. High-powered deer rifle. He and his son were out apparently deer hunting. And then that eye popped from the pressure of the impact. That eyeball, the right eyeball, blew apart, and it hung like an empty plastic bag out of the side of the eye on that side, like a kind of a teardrop mark down it, but it was the sack of the eyeball. And I mean, you could just see all this because part of it, well, here's the thing. When you freeze water, you know how it works. Sometimes parts are milky and other parts are like as clear as air. Well, in this thing, you had parts of it that were milky and parts of it that were as clear as air. And when I saw it when I was 30 years old, I had like eyes like a hawk. I could really see detail. And I paid to go through three. He'd give you about 10 minutes with it, and then he'd boot everybody out and get a new group. So I had to go pay, three different times. I think it was $1, $1.50, something like it. It wasn't much back then. And so I spent about 30 minutes with it, and I really stuck, because I knew this was a golden opportunity. I wasn't going to get another chance. Made notes afterwards, the whole nine yards. I know what I saw.
So where does the story end with this then? I mean, did it just fade away?
No, when you freeze something like that, it doesn't stop it from rotting.
We got the news coming up, but you're okay for about 30 seconds.
All right. Well, it doesn't stop it from rotting entirely, being in ice. And so after about a dozen years or so, 15 years, it had gotten enough decomposed where he didn't take it out anymore. We don't know if he burned the body or buried it or what, but he could have given it to science, and he didn't.
What a shame.
Not a nice.
What an opportunity.
Dan's champing at the bit, aren't you, to get in there? But unfortunately, we've got to take a break for the news. But Lloyd, fascinating stuff. Straight in there with the hominoid stuff. We'll continue with the hominoids and the Bigfoots and the Yetis after the news, and then of course we'll wrap up with the Star Child. But if you want to get in touch, get involved with the show, get your questions in right now. We'll get to some of those after the news, as I say. Text, as always, talk to 61025. We'll get through some of the text, some interesting stuff coming through for you, Lloyd. And also the Facebook is still up and running.
That's right, the group Planet X City Talk 105.9. Just join us, ask to be joined, and I'll sign you up right here and there.
Okay, and if that was all too much information, just go to the website planetxlive.co.uk, and the links are there for the forum, Twitter and Facebook. Back with more from Lloyd after the news. Right, sorted that. Let's get back to Lloyd, and of course we were talking just before the news about the hominoids, the Yetis, the Bigfoots. Dan, I know you were desperate to get a question in.
Yeah, Lloyd, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about where you place the hominoids in the kind of ancestor and descendant of the human race. You kind of have a different view on that.
Well, I have a view that is well grounded in anthropology, except the anthropology mainstream doesn't want to deal with this, so they just ignore it. But there's a book out there called The Upright Ape by Dr. Aaron Filler, and anyone can check this out. Starting at about 20 million years ago, between 20 and 25 million years ago, is an era called the Miocene. And the Miocene, at around 20 to 25 million years ago, is when apes first appear on Earth. And dominantly at that time, it was apes over monkeys. Now it's monkeys over apes by quite a bit. But at the time, it was apes first. And when the apes first appeared, there were quadrupeds and there were upright bipeds. It's pretty clear to see the evidence. Now, that evidence is ignored, but all you have to do is look up Morotopithecus, Oreopithecus, Civopithecus. There's quite a few that look like they have parts that were part of an upright walking ape. So if you will just make that leap of faith, that assumption that this guy, Dr. Aaron Filler, who really knows his stuff, is right, then you have upright apes going back 20 million years. If that is the case, and I do believe it is, and I think the evidence is clear, then what you see today as what are called pre-humans, the ones that look like apes that are walking upright, and I'm talking about all the early Australopithecines, the early Homo, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, right through to Neanderthal, until you get up to Cro-Magnon, through Neanderthal all the way back, you're looking at simply descendants. Now, you're not looking at prehumans. You're looking at descendants of those Miocene apes that go back 20 million years. And when you look at hominoids, you're also looking at descendants of those upright walking primates of 20 million years ago that have just come right now. So they've owned the planet, owned it for like 20 million years. We, and represented by Cro-Magnons, appear here only about 200,000 years ago. Now, that's shocking to a lot of people, but our DNA, the mitochondrial Lee story, shows that very clearly, that our mitochondria in our females shows that we go back about 200,000 years, and then there's nothing like us beyond that point. We just appear. And sure enough, a man named Zechariah Sitchin wrote, as I said in the lecture today, wrote in 1976, that the Sumerians wrote about this, saying that we were created here 200,000 years ago, and 10 years later, modern-day geneticists proved it with the mitochondrial Eve analysis, and, you know, I'm sure everybody's heard that term, mitochondrial Eve. So where do the hominoids fit? They fit where they've always fit. They fit where they fit for 20 million years. They belong here. This is their place. We're interlopers. We're new here, and that's just the truth of it.
Fascinating. I mean, I'm just wondering, Lloyd, if you'd actually come across any information to say that any of these upright walking apes had similar feet to us, because we have quite arched feet, don't we?
No, so their feet were completely different because they're carrying a different body, and they're carrying those bodies in a very different way. And in fact, they walk better than we do. They walk.
So are you suggesting that we've actually de-evolved? If this was the case, if Darwin was right,
we have de-evolved badly. Badly.
Well, that certainly doesn't fit the bill, does it?
Well, it's not just our feet, you know, our feet being the way they are. We don't walk efficiently. We wear our joints out over time, and that's something that they don't do. But we also, you know, just in terms of physical adaptation to the planet, our skin's not that good. Just out exposed to the hot blazing sun all day, we got to put something on it or it's just going to cook off of us. We're not really designed very well to be on this planet out in the open on natural. Some of us are. Some of us, you know, the darker skinned people do have the ability to do that.
But there is obviously some adaptation that has taken place.
Well, absolutely. But the point is that our skin itself is not well adapted at any color to the amount of UV that's coming into the planet. Even people with darker skin can get overexposed and will spend part of every really brutally hot day in some shade, or they'll pay for it.
Well, that's fascinating, because that obviously leads into the fact of, you know, the hair situation, of course, the pouring of eyesight. Our eyesight's obviously got worse, if this is the case.
Right,
years.
Exactly.
How some apes can eat and breathe at the same time, I will presume, as well. Yep. The different, the whole different makeup in the way the genetic
voice structure. Yeah.
What did you ever make of the aquatic ape theory that came out of about 10 years ago? That kind of suggested a kind of an aquatic origin for the human species, and I explained its differences to primates.
It's more like 25 years, I think. Sorry. But you know, Elaine Morgan, the aquatic ape theory. It's fascinating stuff. Absolutely, she's absolutely right, and everything she says about the subcutaneous fat, which we have and primates don't have. You know, like when a primate is cut, I mean, cut badly, they don't have the subcutaneous fat under their skin. So their skin will suture itself, pretty much, will close itself up. Or like, let's say a horse, or let's say, you know, any animal, any natural animal on this planet has that ability to close up a cut and survive it. We get a really serious, severe cut. That cut has to be addressed and closed in some way, or it will infect and we will die from the infection of that. Now, the other mammals that have that problem are the ones that live in the, you know, live in the sea, the manatees, as she points out in her book, very clear about that. So how would we get that subcutaneous fat if we didn't have a period of time of development of for some reason, in water? So it makes sense. But did we develop that here? No, I don't think so. There's not enough time for something like that to develop, to go from Neanderthal men at 300,000 years ago, and Neanderthals 300,000 years ago, and then at around 200,000 years ago, Cro-Magnons just suddenly appear. That's too fast for the really dozens of major physical changes just in the skulls, not counting the body bones there as well. When you look at Neanderthals and you look at Cro-Magnons, you look at us, you know, the ancestors of us. I mean, it's 180 degrees in every direction. The Neanderthals don't have foreheads. We do. The Neanderthals have those huge, big brow ridges. We don't. The Neanderthals have those big, round night vision eyes. We don't. They have those big, wide noses splayed across their faces. We don't. We have a nose sticking off our face. They have a mouth sticking off their face in the prognathous fashion. Our mouth has been pushed back in. They don't have a chin. We have a chin. Every point of reference you can think of, it's 180 degrees between Neanderthal and us.
And, of course, we were always taught in history that
one led to the other.
We never lived together. We never cohabited the planet.
It's just clear it didn't happen. There's no time for all that to change by means of evolution of any kind. It just didn't happen. Cro-Magnons, i.e. us, just appear out of the blue. Boom, magic. Not in the fossil record one day, in the fossil record the next day. We didn't evolve here. We didn't develop here. We were put here. We were engineered to be here. And again, that's just the truth of it. I mean, make of it what you will, but that's what the facts make that, I mean, blindingly clear to anybody that takes a look at them.
Would you say that that's evidence of the lack of genetic disorders in sort of apes and compared to humans?
Right. Well, we have apes and gorillas and just anything that's natural to the planet. Is natural to the planet. They have very few genetic disorders in their gene pool. Very few, relatively speaking. But all domesticated plants and animals, all of which were engineered to be here in a very short time, fairly recently, domesticated plants and animals, and we are just one of those domesticated animals. That's really what we are. So we have, because all of this was sort of made kind of in a hurry under a deadline, we were made very sloppily. At a genetic level, very sloppily. So we have over 4,000 genetic disorders in our collective genome.
Like Dolly the sheep, I guess, then.
Well, yeah. We are very close to being cloned. We look cloned, genetically. There is more genetic variation in one tribe of chimps than there is in all of humanity. So we do have clonish tendencies in terms of genetics. If things that live here in the wild, they have the proper amount of genetic dispersal. We don't have it. We look like what we are, genetically engineered. Our genome shows that we're genetically engineered. We have a fused chromosome, and we have 9 segments in other chromosomes where there was a snip at the top and a snip at the bottom. Somebody pulled part of that chromosome out, flipped it over, and fused it back in so it would continue to work.
Do we see how
nature doesn't do that?
Do we have the technology to do that now? Do you think, Lloyd?
Oh, yeah, we have the technology to do that
so
now.
So basically, so obviously we can look at it. Yeah, how could that have been done? So.
The thing we can't really do, we couldn't really do right now, I don't think. I don't think we have the capacity to fuse our chromosomes the way we do, the way that what happened in our second and third, because what you have to do, and of course science just says, oh, well, it can do it. Nature can do it. There's something called Robertsonian translocation, and it can be done. Don't worry about it. It can happen. It can't, because you have two chromosomes fused together, and for that to happen, the telomeres on the end of one and the telomeres on the end of the other have to be cut off in such a way that when the fusion occurs, the telomeres are gone, but the genes can still function and send messages up and down the line. Then there's another thing called centromeres in chromosomes, and that's how they separate and part. So now you have a centromere in the top part of the gene, of the new gene, the fused gene, and you have a centromere in the bottom. One of those centromeres had better go quiet, or you're going to have a hopeless tangle and it isn't going to work. Well, in us, one of those centromeres has been muted, has been made quiet, so that it doesn't function. Now, again, nature doesn't do things that specifically on that many levels to fuse two genes. It just isn't going to happen. It happened in us, and it happened in us because we were genetically engineered.
It's a classic case of the evidence is there in plain sight.
All you have to do is look. Exactly.
Yeah. Of course, it does suggest the fact, then, that we were kind of put together, in a sense of speaking, genetically engineered.
Well, that's why we don't look like anything here. I mean, okay, let's just say that we descended from primates, all right? Why would we give up primate strength? It's 5 to 10 times more than we have.
Certainly being more advantageous, wouldn't it, for us?
Just why would we give it up? Why would we give up that much strength? Why would we give up the primate bone density, bone thickness? Why would we give that up? Why would we change our body pattern of hair completely? Why would we go from being thick on the back and light on the front, as primates are, to heavy on the front and light on the back, as we are? What's the point of that? Why would we shed so much of it when it exposes us to the light of the sun that we're really not, our skin is not really adapted to deal with? Why would, for example, we get fingernails and hair that won't stop growing, that we have to cut? Primates have hair that grows to a certain length and stops. They have nails that grow to a certain length and stop, that suits their lifestyle. Why would we give that up? Why would we give these things up? To what good does that serve us? Just from a natural standpoint, from a Darwinian standpoint, they say you lose what you don't need and you improve all the time. We're not improving. We're absolutely backsliding big time, except for the brain. I mean, except for the brain. The brain is much bigger, much more powerful. Where did that come from? And that was given to us by those who created us. It wasn't something that we naturally developed. All this nonsense about developing our brain and evolving and all that. If you take a chimp brain and you pull off the outer surface of it, the cortex, and you put that down, it'll be the size of that sheet of paper on your desk right there. If you take the humans off, it's 4 sheets of paper. That's not evolution. That's
but isn't there also evidence, talking about the brain, isn't there evidence that part of our brains are even switched off? We're not using it to the full capacity?
I mean, it's very clear that we're not using our brains nearly. The thing about 10%, and you hear a lot of scientists say, oh, that's nonsense about we don't use but 10% of our brains. We've had them in CAT scans, and we see every part of it light up, and we know we use all of our part of it. Yeah, we have the capacity to use various parts of it, but we don't maximize what it can do. It's like running a car on one wheel, or instead of the whole thing, or a 400 horsepower car on a 20 horsepower. We're not maximizing our brains, and we know that from the many studies that have been done with savants over the years. There are over 100 that have been very carefully studied and chronicled over the years, and they could not do what they do if that capacity was not in all of our brains. And we're talking about all of their incredible math skills, their incredible art skills, their sculpture skills, their mathematical perception skills, their music skills. It just goes down the line. Each of them gets a little blink of a window into the forbidden zone, and the damage to their good part that makes them savants they get that glimpse in where we can't go. We're normal, and the curtain that was put in our brains, we can't see through it, and so we think we're pretty smart where we are right now. But really, given where we could be if we could drop that curtain, it's absolutely mind-boggling. And the day will come that that curtain that is put in our brains, that blockage, that leaves us with, I don't know, it could be 1%. It could be less than 1%. I mean, literally, that's when you look at the scale of what savants can do, we could be operating with 1% or less, not 10%. I mean, literally 1% or less. But whatever we are left with, if that curtain can be dropped, we all get the full 100%, the full Monty. And the full Monty of the brain in our heads would just blow all of us away. But humans in the future, if we keep going on the path we are, we will be able to drop that curtain.
Do you think it's whoever or whatever might have genetically modified us 200,000 years ago? Do you think they've kind of tweaked the brain and said, listen, we don't want them being that clever?
Exactly. You know, we have their brains. I mean, the business in the Bible about we shall make the Adam who in our, the Adam in our own image after our own likeness, that is lifted right out of the Sumerian tablets of 2,000 years earlier. The Bible's 2,000 years ago, and then that's 2,000 more, 4,000 years ago. And in the Sumerian tablets is, we shall make the Adamu, Adam, add a U in. Where do you think Adam came from? It came from the Adamu. Because,
but it's interesting that it says we.
We. Oh, it's, not, of course.
Not God, we.
The gods always in the Sumerian text refer to themselves as plural. And they talk of themselves collectively, we shall do this, we shall do that. There was no one single God. There were multiple gods with a small g rather than a large g. And when they were creating us, of course, one of the first things you do, if you're giving the slave and the servant that you're making your brain and your body, the first thing you want to do is gear the brain way, way down so you're not going to be able to challenge them in any group, situation. So you want your slave and your servant to be a few things, one of which is really stupid compared to you, which we are, and you want them to be extremely obedient to your wishes and to not challenge and not question and not think twice that about, well, why am I obeying this person's orders? This is stupid. And, you know, so they gave us all a sheeple gene, a very, very strong urge to be obedient and obey and to follow orders and not question. And so those of us who are listening to my, who are here and who are listening to my voice right now, they have faulty sheeple genes. They wouldn't be listening to this if they didn't have a faulty sheeple gene. The dominant vast majority of human beings are born with the correctly tuned sheeple gene to just not question, not think, just tell me what to do, let me make my money, let me watch my TV, let me drink my beer, let me bet on my team. You know, sheeple. And the vast majority are that. Only the few of us that are malformed in that gene are doing this kind of work. Now, I have a severely malformed sheeple gene.
I don't think you could get anything for the doctor from that.
And so, you know, I would say all of you do too, but, you know, you can scale it to how your level of interest in this, in alternative knowledge, and how much you are willing to get in there and challenge authority tells you pretty much where you stand with your sheeple gene.
We're going to wrap up with the hominoids topic in just a little while, but I've got a question that I want to throw at you, and I think, have you got a couple of...
I've just got one question.
Sure. Okay. Let's do this one first on the text. This is from Danny. He wants to know, are you familiar with, and I think it had a name, because I've seen a similar documentary, are you familiar with something that was known as the Human Z?
The Human Zoo is Oscar, yeah.
And he toured America, yeah. Didn't he?
No, Oscar.
He lived in America?
Yeah, he lives in America. Oscar was a chimp that I was invited to see, I'd say, 8 or 9 years ago when it came to the San Antonio chimp preserve where it lives now. And you know, a lot of people buy exotic pets and then they can't keep them. They grow up from little whatever and then they can't keep them and then they got to go somewhere. So people put in money to allow this for them to live out their lives. And this is one of those places. And Oliver. So I went to see Oliver, and Oliver is a chimp in every way. He has chimp hands, he has chimp feet, he has a chimp face, he has chimp everything except his pelvis. His pelvis is malformed and is much smaller than an average chimp pelvis. So for him, it's more comfortable to walk upright. So there was all the people that were, you know, anytime you hear something like this, first look at, the, you know, follow the money. Somebody's making money off this idea that this is sort of a chimp and human a hybrid of some kind. But in reality, Oliver was as chimp as any other chimp, except he had that malformed pelvis where he would go down. He would go down on all fours, and he would move around a little bit, but you could see he wasn't working right. He didn't look like the other chimps, but he'd stand up, and he'd waddle. He had a really awkward walk. I mean, it was almost painful to watch. I felt really sorry for him.
Mm. But he was a chimpanzee.
Definitely a chimp.
I mean, it was a black and white photograph.
And they did a DNA test, and I told him, I said, you can expect that to come back as chimp all the way, and it did.
And so it did.
He's just a chimp.
Yeah. Well, I do remember black and white photographs circulating some, you know, numerous years
with
ago.
With a human-like face. And
there was one which was propped up by, its head was propped up by...
Deloitte's ape. That's Deloitte's ape. And that's just a big, it had a tail, so it's a big monkey of some kind.
Yeah, of course, but the way they made it posture made it look more, of course. And of course, like you say, follow the money, don't you?
Dan, quickly, you've got a couple of questions.
It's not strictly on hominoids, but before we get off the whole topic of human origins or that kind of thing, I've always wanted to ask this question. What are your thoughts on the evidence or the artifacts that are out there that suggest an even greater antiquity for modern anatomically, like humans, you know, the kind of jaw bones and fossils that have been found and fossilized shoe prints, you know, going back like 55 million years, 200 million years, that kind of thing.
And the stuff that Michael Cremo does.
Yeah, exactly that. I always wonder what you thought about that, because you've always had a strong kind of...
Good question. Yeah, it is a good question. Yeah. Anything like that goes back that far in time, past 200,000 years, is going to be human-like, obviously, but not human, not us. I mean, when you call us human... We're it. If you just, that term is reserved for us, that doesn't go past 200,000 years. But human-like, we're modeled after another species, the Anunnaki, and then they could be modeled after another species, another, you know, it could go back. So this form that we wear, this form that we have, this upright walking, you know, body, could go back millions of years. It could, but it's a different model. If you were to test its chromosomes or its mitochondrial DNA or its nuclear DNA, you'd find significant differences. You'd find significant similarities. If a chimp can have 97% the same as us, they could have 98, 98.5, 99, 99.5, and still not be us. And that's what I think.
Just to wrap up the hominoid talk that we were doing, are we ever going to see good evidence, or is it like, and we were talking about it before we came on the show, is it going to be like, I don't know, the alien subjects? Is it going to be like the UFOs? Anything that challenges the mainstream archaeology, mainstream history, if somebody sort of pick, you know, out of, you know, a Bigfoot tomorrow, Would it get covered up? Is what I'm trying to get to.
Would it get to the mainstream?
They have been shot and killed, hit by cars, a number of things like that in the States. But what happens is big money interests immediately contact the people who've done it, and they let them know they'll buy it for some, you know, outrageous amount of money if they'll just keep it quiet. And this is done because of something in America of many years ago called the snail darter, where whole swaths of California were laid off from development, isolated from development because there was a little fish in there called a snail darter. And everybody learned that if something is endangered, the government will seal off that area to protect it. All right? So the timber interests, the farming interests, the ranching interests, we're talking big agribusiness, big timber and all that, particularly big timber. If a Bigfoot is killed in an area where logging is being done at a serious level, that's going to put a huge crimp in that area's business. It's a lot easier for them to pay $250,000, $500,000 to somebody. Mm. You know, let me buy the body. You're not going to make more off of it than that over time. And so there are many stories of people doing that. And I've talked to people who know for a fact that it's happened, that things have been, you know, bought off like that. And you just have to go along with it. Sooner or later, the right kind of person and the right kind of circumstance is going to nail one. But when you do that, you've got a long trek to get the body back to civilization. Mm-hmm. Word spreads, yep, and people can be bought off. And it's always in these small, isolated areas where they're just bumping up against the edge of the hominoid environment. But if they ever get down into a different, you know, a more populous area, it could happen any day. I mean, it could happen literally tomorrow. Yeah. Any minute of any day, this can happen. Just like any minute of any day, a UFO can hover over a football stadium where everybody's.
Are there any locations where it's actually, they've classed it illegal to shoot these?
There was a law passed, I think, in Washington State at one time because they had so many sightings. And I think it was Washington State that passed a law that said it was illegal. And that's one of the things that, Frank Hansen was worried about, that even if there wasn't a law on the books, what is to say that these things will not be classified as an aberrant kind of human, kind of just a really poor, poor smelly cousin, you know? And then, therefore, you've killed a human, and Hansen was afraid.
That's another way of keeping the lid on it, and control over it.
Keep people afraid to do it, but it will happen. Eventually, it will happen.
Well, as you say, with technology going the way it is, you know, everyone's got a camera phone,
right.
We've got the internet, it's going to happen at some point.
Well, I have a friend who works the field called Jason Valenti, who's got a really good plan to tether small dirigibles, but you know, airships, small ones, but tether them up a couple of hundred feet with really, really good infrared cameras underneath.
That's a very good idea.
Oh, great idea.
Yeah.
And just have them tethered on the trees, looking down, scouring the land at night. These are nocturnal creatures. They move mostly at night. And when you get that heat signature of a big upright, you know, biped, that's what you're looking for. And then you've got to go through the process of darting it, trying to anyway. Now, the problem with darting it, and everyone needs to understand, they don't want to just go up and shoot it. They want to try to get a live specimen if they can. But you don't know how much of the tranquilizer to put in the dart. Do you do enough for, say, a water buffalo? Do you do enough for an elephant? What do? You got to get the right amount to not kill it. And that's going to be tricky. But that's their plan, and that's their goal, and
all we can do is assume it's, you know, what it would be for, say, a 7-foot human.
Well,
just have a guess.
But they have different musculature. They have different bones. If you put too little, they get away. If you put too much, you kill them. It's the Goldilocks zone of this. It's a tough one to figure out.
Got to leave it there, guys. Fascinating stuff. The hominoids. We're going to get back with Lloyd in just a tick and finish off the show with a good old talk about the Star Child Skull.
The radio show that officially does not exist. This is Planet X. Planet X on City Talk 105.9. The truth is on air. City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. We're talking to Lloyd Pye live in the studio, and the clock is nearly beaten us, so we're going to get straight into the Star Child Skull. Apologies if we don't get time to ask any of the questions, because we're going to run out of time. But let's just briefly mention the Star Child Skull. 13 years you've been trying to get to the bottom of the mystery of this 900-year-old skull found in Mexico.
Right.
And you've had all kinds of tests done, but now working with the latest technology, the new Genesis, you're finally just getting there now.
Yeah, it's very exciting. After 13 years, we finally have gotten enough partial DNA returns so that we know beyond a shadow of a doubt what the final result is going to be. Because DNA being what it is, if you get a part of it that is significantly representative of what else is there, there's really no doubt that in the end you're going to get a certain result. And we have now recovered, our geneticist has now recovered, of the 3+ billion with a B, base pairs that are found in the nuclear DNA, we've got about 50 million base pairs. Now, that's not yet mathematically significant, but it tells us an awful lot about it. And what it tells us is that part of the Star Child's DNA, about half of those 50 million base pairs, have corollaries within the human genome or within species of animals on Earth. It's not all human, but when you understand that everything has DNA like humans, then it puts it in perspective. Just because it has DNA like human doesn't mean that it is human. Chimp DNA is 97% the same as ours. Gorilla is 95. Rat is 70. Mouse is 65. Yeast is 20. So you see that it's all connected. What is significant about the Star Child's fragments that we've recovered to equal up to the 50 million that we're talking about, what is significant is that about half of those are not found in the databases that have been collected so far of life on Earth, meaning a very strong indication that a huge chunk of the Star Child's DNA is just simply not earthly. And that in itself is very significant. And then we've done some mitochondrial DNA and some working DNA that we talked about in the lecture today, and it's all overwhelming.
How do you feel? Because it's almost like you're coming to the end of the journey now, you know, and you've had the ups and the downs, but now the you know, you've certainly got a lot more of the ups now, because it's proven without a doubt it is not of this earth.
Well, they have a term for it in prison. It's called short timing. And they have found that when someone is going to, you know, getting near the end of a 5-year, 10-year, 15, 20-year sentence, they're most likely to make a break in the last 6 months because they just can't wait to get it over with. And so a lot of prisons, at least in the old days, would begin to isolate those prisoners about 6 months out to just to make sure that they didn't run for it and you know, get another sentence for no more than just being a little bit crazy toward the end as they were short-timing. So I'm feeling a lot short, like a short-timer. I want it over with. I just want to get it done now that we're here.
Dan's got a quick question.
Interesting question on that from Darren on the Facebook here. He's saying, how you, if this all does come to fruition and right. then it comes out in the media, how are you going to handle the global attention?
Well, you know, you just do the best you can. Nobody really can plan for that, but we're making some preparations for it. Mm. We certainly know how we, you know, where we want to do the press conference and how we want to go about that and how we want to announce it and where. And we just have to wait for the wind. And the wind will come when we find somebody with the money that wants to invest in this. Again, not we're not looking for charity. We're looking for an investment. It's a business deal. They help us. We help them, that kind of thing, with film revenue from it, because you have to film it. You might as well turn it into a documentary film and make your money back. So when we are able to connect with that kind of person, whoever that person is, we will then, things will fall into place based on, you know, the way it's traditionally done in a situation like this. You know, you call a press conference, you announce, you let people know what's going on, you let people know what is going to go on, what you're planning to do, and then you periodically update as things develop.
You mentioned in the talk today that you think that you could be a part of the drip feed process to get the information to eventually get disclosure on the whole alien agenda, because they've kind of left you alone now, haven't they?
Right. The one thing that I was told when I first got the Star Child 13, almost 14 years ago, was that I wasn't going to be allowed to keep it. I was going, you know, something bad was going to happen to me. It was going to be taken from me because the, quote, powers that be would never let this come out. And that was back in early 1999, February of 1999, so it's some time ago. And yet here I sit, and they've allowed me to go this far with it, and I have not been stopped. And so there's some value in it for them. There has to be some value in it for them, or I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you about it. And the value in it for them, I think, is that the Star Child is a perfect, ideal, midway stepping stone to full disclosure. Full disclosure is going to be a radical shock for a lot of people. As I said in the slideshow, like in the 1500s, when people had to adjust to the idea that the Earth was not the center of everything.
Mm. Yeah.
When they had to finally buy into the idea that Earth was just ordinary. Ordinary, ordinary, beyond ordinary. Well, when in the same way that they were convinced that they were the physical center of everything, we in our time are convinced that we are the biological center of everything. Mm. So the shock is going to be equal, that we are not the biological center of everything, and we're going to have to adapt and adjust just like they did in the 1500s. And it wasn't an overnight thing. It was a long struggle. So the Star Child provides a middle step toward full disclosure because it was 900 years ago. It came from 900 years ago. So it allows those who are not ready to make the step fully yet to say, okay, well, you had this alien on Earth. Yes, okay, 900 years ago, one time, one alien, and okay, aliens might be out there. But that doesn't mean that all these UFO things you say you're seeing, you know, that doesn't mean that's real. And it lets those who want that to be real to have now have a very solid footing for moving forward and planning their thinking and moving in an agenda toward actual realities.
Absolutely, yeah, because it's not like they're landing on the White House lawn. It was 900 years ago, so I might be able to cope with that. Guys, we've literally got a minute, so I don't know if you want to get a question in.
I just want to mention, I'm sure Dan will agree with me, the theory was, there's some documented evidence to support the fact that the Americans were considering disclosure in the 1970s. We've touched on this subject before, haven't we, on the show? And it certainly would be in agreement now that there is kind of a drip feed process going on. It's in today's society, it's in the media, it's in newspapers, the kids are reading it in schools, it's in cartoons, in magazines, you can't get away from it. Everybody's conscious of this sort of thing, this subject, and certainly Lloyd is lending a hand maybe to that, and maybe Lloyd could be, you know, the information that Lloyd's coming out could be that information that we're lending for, that the disclosure.
We do program, think, you know, it's the tipping point. It certainly is.
Certainly here in Liverpool, as we mentioned earlier, it's been a monumentous week for the truth coming out, and let's hope it continues. Lloyd, let's just wrap up. Anything you want to say before we have to finish? Contact details?
If people are interested and would like to find out more about this, they can go to starchildproject.com, starchildproject.com for that kind of information. For the hominoid and human origins material, you can go to lloydpye.com, lloydpye.com. And I have a couple of ebooks that are very cheap and easy to get through, lots of good illustrations, Starchild Skull Essentials and Intervention Theory Essentials, and that will bring you up to speed.
As we always say on the show, it's great research that you do. It's great science that you do. It's not wacko stuff out there. Just read the books, do the research, and you know, you make your own conclusions. But it is fascinating stuff. And long may it continue. Thank you, Lloyd Pye.
No, short may it continue.
Yes.
Short timing.
We want to know.
The hominoid.
Yeah. Sorry, Lord Lloyd Pye. Thank you very much.